Yesterday, I talked with you, first of all, about reasons to believe that God exists from what we observe in nature. And then we looked at who Jesus is, and then reasons to believe that Jesus is the Son of God on the basis of his resurrection. Well, it's the resurrection that Paul is talking about here in 1 Corinthians 15. Not only the resurrection of Christ, but also the resurrection of all of us. And in the midst of his comments about the consequences of denying that there is a resurrection, Paul makes this comment to the Corinthians. I'm going to start in verse 32. What do I gain if, humanly speaking, that's how my Bible puts it. In other words, ignoring the idea of an afterlife, ignoring the idea of life with God forever, if all there is what we as human beings can see in our natural observation of the world. He says, what do I gain if, humanly speaking, I fought with beasts at Ephesus? You might remember that according to the end of the book, Paul is at Ephesus when he writes this letter. And you may recall in the book of Acts that his preaching had such an impact in Ephesus that those who were the silversmiths, who made the idols that people could take home, instigated such a foment against the Apostle Paul that there's actually a riot in the city. And Paul's friends even fear for his life. Some people think that's what Paul's talking about here, that he's not talking about literal animals that he had to fight, but rather these beastly opponents of his at Ephesus. But who knows, maybe in the 3 years he was there, there were some episodes where Paul literally had to fight for his life. And his point then is this, if there's no afterlife, if this life is all there is, why would I have put my life on the line and risk so much at Ephesus? And then he says this in verse 32, if the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. If your Bible has cross references, it may point you back to the book of Isaiah in that statement, to Isaiah 22. It's a statement of the people of Jerusalem besieged by the Assyrians. And rather than realizing this is the judgment of God and accepting their need to repent and turn back to God, they have decided instead to just party like there's no tomorrow because as far as they're concerned, there is no tomorrow. Once the Assyrians come over the wall and once they're slaughtered, that's the end of everything. So you might as well just desensitize yourself to life's troubles by eating and drinking as much as you can. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. Well, of course, if you're a pagan and you don't believe there is a God or you don't believe there is an afterlife, that would go double for you. Why worry about the kind of life you lead? Why worry about things like right and wrong? Why worry about having goals and objectives and a purpose and mission in life? If death is the end and that's it, just eat and drink, for tomorrow you die. So here's what I want to do tonight. Yesterday I presented for you the positive case for belief in God and in Jesus Christ. What I want to do tonight is look at the negative case. In other words, I want us to be brought and confronted face to face with the implications of what it would mean if there is no God, if there is no afterlife, if this life is all there is, just like Paul says, is really the case if there is no resurrection. Now, the troubling reality is we live in a culture in which more people than ever before have decided that this is the truth, that there is no afterlife, that there is no God. Here's the results of a survey that was released week before last, and I realize these various configured lines are hard probably to make out from your seat. So, first of all, let me just say this. They're all going in the wrong direction. This is a survey of the religious attitudes of 18 to 29-year-olds from 1972, that's the far left-hand side of the screen, to the most recent information available in 2014, that's on the right. The single solid line that you see up there refers to those who have no religious affiliation. And as you can see, that solid black line has risen steadily to now it's over 30%. Even more perplexing to me, if you see the dotted line are those who have never attended any religious services. Any. In other words, I don't know about you, but not long ago, we had people show up on Easter. They don't show up any other time of the year, but they're there on Easter. You know, there's at least some people who will show up to church a couple times a year. Well, almost 35% of 18 to 29-year-olds don't even do that. And then most troubling of all, and I know it's hard to make out, but there's a line here that represents those who never pray. Never pray. There are even atheists who, when they get in trouble, will pray. But these are people who never pray. And the line of those who never pray is right about 25%. And you can also see how these numbers have grown dramatically, especially over the last little bit on this chart. And I know it's hard to make out, but right here is the year 2002. And do you see especially how all of these numbers spike in the wrong direction right about 2002 and beyond? Can you think of anything that happened around that time that might have some impact here? Well, of course, 9/11 happened in 2001. And because 9/11 involved radical Islamic terrorism, there were people who decided to latch onto this as the opportunity to bash all religion. And so after 2001, several books were written by people known as the New Atheists. What's new is not their atheism, that's very old. But what is new is the evangelical fervor of their preaching atheism. And you can see then that their preaching has had a powerful impact. They're making a lot of converts or deconverts to their way of looking at things. So the situation you and I are in is one in which our culture generally, but especially young people particularly, are in an absolute tailspin when it comes to faith. Gone are the days when you could count on the fact that you and your neighbor shared certain common assumptions. God exists, Jesus is his son, the Bible is his word, and then you could have discussions about specific theological issues. Those days are gone. Now, more and more, the issue is going to be not just simply how do we understand the Bible, but how do we understand what the Bible is? Not just simply how do we follow Jesus, but why should we follow Jesus? Not what does God say, but who is God? What is God? Why should we even believe that he exists? And yet, I don't think the vast majority of these 18 to 29-year-olds have seriously confronted the absolute incoherence of what it is to say there is no God. And so my goal tonight is to make it absolutely clear what a blunder it is to deny that God exists. And the way that I want to do this tonight is by using a book written by an atheist philosophy professor named Alex Rosenberg. The book is called The Atheist's Guide to Reality, Enjoying Life Without Illusions. So tonight, you're not going to have to take my word for what an atheist worldview is like. We're going to let him tell you what it is like. And I just want to point out to you what an incoherent mess this actually is. In fact, I hope that by the end of the lesson tonight, you will understand that according to atheism, all that really exists are colorless crayons. That doesn't make sense now, but hopefully by the end of the lesson, you'll see what I'm talking about. Now, I mentioned to you a minute ago the impact of 9/11 and how 9/11 has been exploited by those who don't see it as the narrow fringe of radical Muslims, but instead all religion is poisonous, violent, and terrible for the world. There is another reason, though, that atheism has skyrocketed over the last few years, and it has to do with technology. I mean, right down here on the pew, I left my iPhone. That phone is far more powerful by many magnitudes than the first computer I bought 25 years ago. And it can do amazing. I wish now I brought it up here with you because I would ask Siri random questions and she can just answer them for you. The technology here is truly amazing. Well, here is then the mindset that I think has in part contributed to the rise of atheism. When we consider the changes in our society over the last 100 years, how science has made technology and the advance of technology so powerful and so amazing, what that must mean is that science has all the answers. And if science has all the answers, the only questions that matter are the questions science can answer. This view of things is called scientism, and it is at the heart of the new atheism. Rosenberg says in his book, "Scientism is the conviction that the methods of science are the only reliable ways to secure knowledge of anything." So think about it. How, by the scientific method, can you say anything about God? You Christians claim God is beyond the natural world. Science only studies the natural world. If science is all that is really true, then only things in the natural world are true. So therefore, God, by definition, can't even exist. And the reason he takes this view is because the technological success of physics is by itself enough to convince anyone with anxiety about scientism that if physics isn't finished, it certainly has the broad outlines of reality well understood. In other words, if you just think about how physics and our knowledge of the natural world has answered so many questions, that ought to pretty well convince you that if it hasn't answered the questions yet, it will eventually. Now, there's a couple of problems with this view. I read an expression one time that said, "He that is good with a hammer thinks everything is a nail." And that's kind of my ability at construction. If I can't do it with a hammer, it's beyond my ability to do something. Well, these people who advocate scientism remind me of the person who thinks that everything is a nail because they're good with a hammer. Physics and science are, of course, tremendously valuable for what their purpose is. I don't know a whole lot about science. In fact, the only equation I really know from physics is this one. It's the one I guess just about everybody knows, right? Einstein's equation, right, for relativity. But don't ask me to explain what the letters are and what relativity is. But I mean, that's the equation we all know. And physics is great at analyzing nature, coming up with ways to describe nature in numbers. But let me ask you this question. Physics can help us to understand how nuclear fission works. Can physics tell us anything about when it is right or wrong to drop a nuclear bomb? Of course not. Not by normal common sense, right? But guess what? If you accept the premise that science has the answer to all questions, then according to Rosenberg, yes, physics does tell us not simply what the equation is for relativity, but physics gives us all the answers, even to questions like war and peace and what is right and what is wrong. Well, that's obviously foolish. It would be like somebody who has a metal detector and goes to the beach and says, "Since I can't find a jellyfish with a metal detector, jellyfish don't exist." Well, a metal detector isn't equipped to find jellyfish. It finds pieces of metal. It only answers one narrow set of questions. Where is the metal? It doesn't answer all other questions about what exists. See the point? Physics is the same. It answers certain questions, but claiming that physics answers all questions is like saying if you can't find it with a metal detector, it doesn't even exist. So that's one problem. But here's another problem with scientism. Remember, he says that scientism is the conviction that the methods of science are the only reliable ways to secure knowledge of anything. Question. Dr. Rosenberg, how did you arrive at that knowledge? How did you arrive at the knowledge that the methods of science are the only reliable ways to secure knowledge? Did you arrive at this knowledge by the scientific method, by a physics equation? What's the answer to that question? No. Obviously, you cannot make this assertion on the basis of physics or science. This is an assertion from philosophy. It's actually a religious assertion. It's not a science assertion. And so the very statement that science is the only reliable form of knowledge can't be established by science. And so therefore, it's like a family sitting on the tree limb and cutting off the branch it sits on. Once you make the claim that science has all the answers, and you can't prove that claim by science, you are admitting there are some answers science doesn't have. So here is problem number one with this outlook. Scientism is self-refuting. That's bad enough. We could stop right now. We have invitation song right now, but I'm going to wear you out tonight. See, I got a fan and I learned how to turn it on. So now I can preach all night long. So we're going to talk about a lot more problems. This is the first one. This would be enough, right? This would be enough to say this is ridiculous. But it gets much worse than this. Think about the idea that physics has all the answers. Now, if you read Rosenberg's book, one of the things he likes to say over and over is all that exists are lumps of stuff. And we can describe those by equations in physics. Now, I want you to think about this just for a second. I'm going to illustrate it. I made an incredible visual aid tonight. I mean, I worked so hard. This reflects the sum total of my artistic ability. All right? So here it is. I don't know if you can see what this is. It's the number 2. All right, so I have a question for you guys tonight. I have the number 2 is written here on this piece of paper. If I tear this up like this, have I destroyed the number 2? No. I've destroyed this written digit of the number 2, but I haven't destroyed the number 2. What if I went through every songbook and every page that had the number 2 written out? What if I destroyed all those? Have I destroyed the number 2? What if I went through all of Alton, Illinois, and destroyed every written number 2? Have I destroyed the number 2? Why not? And the answer is because the number 2 is not a physical object that can be destroyed. The number 2 is an abstract object. So if I went over the entire planet and ripped up every number 2 that's been written down, the number 2 still exists, and 2 plus 2 would still be 4. Do you agree with me? Well, think about this then, okay? He likes to say in his book that all that exists are lumps of stuff. That's all there is, quantified by physics. And yet, in order to write out the equations of physics, what do you have to use? Numbers. And yet, as we just illustrated, numbers are not lumps of stuff. They are abstract objects, which means that the only way to do physics is to believe that there's something besides lumps of stuff, namely abstract objects like numbers. You follow me? Anytime you write a physics equation, you're using numbers, which we already said are not physical objects. They're abstract concepts, which means in order to do physics, there's one thing for sure you have to believe in, namely that all that exists is not lumps of stuff, which means that in order to do physics, you must deny scientism, or else you can't really do physics. See that? So if you accept this viewpoint, not only is scientism self-refuting, physics as an enterprise does not even exist. Now, we could stop here, but guess what? This gets much worse than this. Here's how it gets worse. If all that exists are lumps of stuff, can a lump of stuff have any meaning or purpose? Of course not. In fact, Rosenberg says in his book, individual human life is meaningless, without a purpose, and without ultimate moral value. He says, here's what I believe in. I believe in a nice sort of nihilism. Now, that's not a word we use a whole lot. But if you want to know what nihilism means, here's an easy way to remember it. Have you ever heard the song, I've got plenty of nothing and nothing's plenty for me? That's nihilism. And that's what he says about the meaning or purpose in life. Since all that exists are lumps of stuff, and lumps of stuff cannot have any meaning or purpose, therefore, there is no meaning or purpose in life. So meaning does not exist by the worldview of atheism. There is no purpose or meaning to life. But it gets even worse than this. Why does it get worse than this? Here's the reason why. If all that exists are lumps of stuff, what does that mean about the mind? So here you have a picture of the human brain, and here you have a picture of one of the great thinkers in world history, and he's contemplating one of my favorite ideas, actually. All right, now then, if all that exists are clumps of stuff, then what is the mind? Really, all you could say is that the mind is the brain, and the brain is the mind. And so when we are thinking, really all that is happening is we are having certain chemical actions in an organ of the body, and that's it. Now then, since the mind is simply the brain, and since, according to Rosenberg, physics controls everything, then every state of my brain is fixed by physical facts. So therefore, there is no free will, just the feeling or the illusion of introspection. In other words, just like the laws of physics control things like gravity, the laws of physics are controlling what's taking place in your brain, which means you really don't choose to do anything. There is no free will. It's simply your brain being governed by the immutable laws of physics. So therefore, free will does not exist. You didn't choose to come here tonight. You didn't choose what to have for supper tonight. You're not going to choose when to get up in your morning. The laws of physics are determining that, because all that exists are lumps of stuff. But it gets even worse than this. And here's why it gets worse. If there is no free will, back the slide up one, please, if you would, because I know you guys will start reading while I'm trying to talk. So hang on just a minute here. If there's no free will, then on what basis could you punish a criminal? So, for example, there were recently terror attacks over in Brussels. And we would say to perpetrate such a crime is a terrible offense against right and wrong in the laws, and the people who did it should be punished. But that's assuming that they can be responsible for what they did. But if there is no free will, and what we do is simply governed by physics, then did those terrorists have any choice in what they did? And what's the answer? No, they did not. And if they have no choice in what they're doing, how could you really punish them for what they did? Well, that's not a problem, because according to the atheist worldview, not only does free will not exist, right and wrong don't exist. So he says this: nihilism rejects the distinction between acts that are morally permitted, forbidden, and required. It claims that they are all based on false, groundless presuppositions. The next quote: nihilism can't condemn Hitler and Stalin. Nihilism seems to cut that ground out from under us. In other words, if we're not responsible for our actions, not only are grotesque murderers like those terrorists not responsible, some of the worst murderers in history had no choice in what they were doing. So how could you hold them responsible as well? The last quote here, he says, scientism can't avoid nihilism. We just need to make the best of it. Now, isn't that a reassuring view of the world? Now, think about this point just a little bit further. Every one of us here would agree that what the Nazis did was horrible. But if they had no free will, and if there's no right and wrong, on what basis could you even criticize their actions? Well, here's what Rosenberg says in his book. He says, outside of the psychopaths among them, which is one of the most ridiculous phrases ever written in the English language, but just moving along here, outside of the psychopaths among them, Nazis were right to think that to a large extent they shared our core morality. Now, what in the world is he talking about? Well, what he's talking about is, even at the war crimes trials at Nuremberg, the Nazis tried to defend themselves, which means they believed in their twisted way of thinking that somehow what they did was right, which means that they think there is a right and wrong. So he says, you know, at least for the really, really crazy ones, they shared our morality. He says it was their wildly false factual beliefs that led to the moral catastrophe. In other words, the real problem here is they just had wrong beliefs about certain things. But here is the problem. According to the view of an atheist, all that we think and all that we believe is ultimately the result of physics, and in the case of us, it is the result of random evolution. So he says just a few pages later, there's lots of evidence that natural selection is not very good at picking out true beliefs. In other words, natural selection does things like this. How many of you all have like an attached earlobe versus a separate one? You know what I mean? How many of y'all can roll your tongue? You know those things you always learn in grade school about natural selection? Well, natural selection does those things. Can natural selection tell you what is right and wrong? He says, no, it's not very good at picking out true beliefs. There are lots of moral values and ethical norms that enlightened people reject, but Mother Nature has strongly selected for. Racism and xenophobia, the fear of strangers, are optimally adapted to maximize the representation of your genes. If you don't know what he's saying, here's what he's saying. That Mother Nature makes us more likely to distrust people who look different than us because that will increase our chances of survival. But wait a minute. If your criticism was the Nazis had certain false beliefs, but 3 or 4 pages later you say, well, you know, actually, there aren't really true and false beliefs, how could you even criticize the Nazis? Do you see what this worldview leaves you with? It leaves you with the fact that morality itself does not even exist. You have no free will, and there is no right or wrong. And you're thinking, surely it can't get any worse than this. But guess what? It gets much worse than this. And here is the reason why. If the mind is just simply the brain, and what we call thinking are simply physical states, no different than breathing, no different than digestion, then this not only means that there is no right and wrong to think about, it also means there's no thinking about anything. Rosenberg says in his book, how can one clump of stuff anywhere in the universe be about some other clump of stuff? So look at Homer Simpson here. It appears as if he's thinking about one of my favorite subjects, donuts. But if scientism is true, is there any difference between his brain and the donut? No. Furthermore, if scientism is true, is there any difference between his thinking about the donut and the donut? No, because lumps of stuff don't think about anything. So the problem here is not just simply that we can't think about right and wrong. We can't think about anything, period. He goes on to say this. The brain's neural states, like the states of the semiconductor circuits in a Mac or PC, are by themselves intrinsically not about anything at all. Do you see what he's saying? You don't think about anything. He goes on to say this. When consciousness assures us that we have thoughts about stuff, it has to be wrong. The brain non-consciously stores information and thoughts, but the thoughts are not about stuff. So here's the question that I want to ask Professor Rosenberg. Hey, Professor Rosenberg, what is your book about? And the only consistent answer he could give is what? Nothing. I got plenty of nothing, and nothing's plenty for me. That's it. It can't be about anything because we don't think about anything. So by this view of the world, there is no free will, there is no morality. In fact, there's no thinking at all. Thinking doesn't exist. Can it get worse? Yes, it can get much worse than this. And here's the reason why. If you notice in this bottom quote here, he says, the brain non-consciously stores information in thoughts. In other words, not only do you and I think that we think, you and I think that we are conscious. But of course, a donut is not conscious of its own existence. This pulpit is not conscious of its own existence. It doesn't think about anything, but it doesn't even think that it thinks about anything. You and I think that we think about stuff because we think that we are conscious. But if all we are lumps of stuff, there is no consciousness. There is no real self that thinks about anything. And so Rosenberg goes on to say this. There is no self, soul, or person. Scientism must firmly deny its existence. The self as conveyed to us by introspection is a fiction. It doesn't exist. The notion of an enduring self is another part of the mistake that introspection makes. Now, maybe it's at this point that you're thinking, you can't be serious. You actually think that we don't think, and that furthermore, we're not even conscious? That's what some of these people think. Let me illustrate it for you like this. How many of you have ever seen a pain chart like this? For some of you, this brings back terrible memories, doesn't it? You go to the hospital and they have one of these pain charts, and it's asking you, how do you feel? Now think about this just for a second. Recently, I had a test in which they hooked up a bunch of electrodes to me and took a scan of my heart rate. Now you can do that with a machine. You can take a scan and get numbers of how fast is somebody's heart beating and so forth. But could that machine tell the nurse anything about how I felt? No. You see, how you feel and what a machine or test can uncover are two different things. And so what this is asking for is how you feel. They can do physical tests on you to come up with numbers like your, you know, your blood pressure and your heart rate and your cholesterol and all that kind of stuff. But only you as a conscious person can say how you feel. But do you understand that if you believe that all that exists is lumps of stuff, there is no you to feel anything? All that exists are what can be derived by the numbers that the tests abstract from you. And so here is another one of these atheist thinkers who says this. The absurdity of saying nobody has ever felt a pain. Now, you and I would think, well, that's absurd. Of course, I feel pain. No, you don't. There's no conscious you to feel anything. So he says, well, I know that might sound weird, but it's no greater than saying nobody's ever seen a demon. It would make it simpler for us if you would say, my C fibers are firing, instead of, I'm in pain. So just imagine my friend Terry back here, who's a nurse, goes into the room of a patient and says, how are you feeling today? And they say, well, you know, I feel a lot of... No, just tell me, are your C fibers firing or not? Well, that's ridiculous. But that's what you're led to if you deny that there is any conscious self. So the conscious self does not exist. If you're sitting there thinking, well, how many more of these, it can't get worse than they're going to be? You're not really thinking that, as you're not really conscious. And I'm used to preaching to a lot of people who don't look like they're conscious, but I'm just telling all of you, you're not conscious, all right? But it does get worse than this, all right? How does it get worse than this? Well, let me explain. Remember I said to you a moment ago that one of the reasons scientism has exploded in popularity is because of all of the technological progress that is made through science and physics, we can make predictions about the future. And because of that, people say, look at the predictive success of science. Science has all the answers. And we can look back at the past, like evolutionists do, and say, Well, see, we can see what has happened in the past. In fact, in his book, he says at one spot that scientism dictates a thoroughly Darwinian understanding of humans and our evolution. But here is the problem. If you don't think and you don't have conscious thoughts about anything, can you do any predicting of the future? No. And can you do any summarizing of the past? No. So he says, science must deny the basic notion that we ever really think about the past and the future, or even that our conscious thoughts ever give any meaning. Well, wait a minute. If your big argument for scientism is it predicts the future so well and it explains the past so well, but on the same breath you're telling me scientism can't think about the future or the past, what have you done to your two big proofs? You've completely eliminated them. And so the basis for scientism does not even exist. But guess what? It does! It gets worse! That's exactly right! It gets much worse than this. Now let me tell you why it gets worse than this. The subtitle of his book is How to Deal with the Illusion of Life. All these things that we think we experience, right and wrong, free will, intention, consciousness, thinking itself, are just an illusion. And you say, well, Dr. Rosenberg, if this is merely an illusion, why even write your book? Because it's an illusion too. And then he says, well, look, if I'm going to get scientism into your skull, I have to use the only tools we've got for moving information from one head to another. Noises, ink marks, pixels. Those are lumps of stuff, right? You can see them, touch them, hear them. That's all that exists. Treat the illusion that goes with them like an optical illusion he mentioned earlier. I want you to think about this for a second. Here's a picture of the son of one of our members, and he's over in Italy, and he's doing the classic picture in front of the Leaning Tower of Pisa to make it look like his hand is up and holding up the Leaning Tower of Pisa from falling. And we all know that that is an illusion. Think about this. Why do we describe that as an illusion? There's only one reason. Because we know what the truth is. And since we know that the truth of the matter is one person cannot hold up the Leaning Tower of Pisa, since we know what the truth is, we can speak about what an illusion is. If there had never been a person who ever really saw the Leaning Tower of Pisa and who really knew that a person could do this, we wouldn't know that that was an illusion, would we? All right, so here is the point I want you to see. The word illusion only has meaning if there is a corresponding reality that you can say that's an illusion of. But according to Professor Rosenberg, there is no true reality of anything that we think about, that we feel, that we reason about. And so therefore, you can't even talk about the word illusion and have any meaning at all. It can't be a truthful statement because there isn't any truth to think about. And so illusion as a concept does not even exist. Now, at the start of the lesson, I said that I hope that by the end of the lesson, I can convince you that according to this view of the world, all that exists are colorless crayons. So let me explain what I'm talking about. When I was in the third grade, my friend John Brooks had the crayons, and I wanted the crayons, and he wouldn't give them to me, and so I started to wring his neck. Now, I'm not bragging about that. It was the wrong thing to do. But if I want the crayons, you better give them to me. All right, John, I'm saying, apparently it sets me off here, all right? So I want you to look, consider this statement. I am reflecting on whether I should have chosen to cause pain to John Brooks to get the colored crayons. Now, I want you to think about everything that we've talked about tonight. Remember that according to this worldview, there is no right and wrong. There is no morality. And so words like should have absolutely no meaning. There is no should and should not have. So let's scratch that off the list. But remember, according to this view, there is no free will either. Everything that I do is controlled by the laws of physics. What I think about as choosing is actually just the determination of science itself. And so as a result of that, I can scratch off the words have chosen, because I didn't really choose to wring poor John Brooks' neck. The laws of physics determine that I wring his neck. But we can go further, because remember that according to this way of view of the world, there's no such thing as thinking itself. So am I really doing any reflecting? No, I'm not. So let's scratch that one off the list as well. But remember that what this view of the world says is that I'm not simply not able to think. There is no consciousness as well. There's no intention that I'm going to do something. There's no me to choose to do that. And so anytime you see the word to, as in to cause pain, then you've got to scratch that off. Or to get the colored crayons, because there's no intention to do anything, even to get crayons. But remember that according to this view of the world, there's not even any conscious experience of things like pain or of things like color. And there's no self that can do these things. And so we can scratch off next pain and color. Because John Brooks may have said he had pain, but remember, all he could truthfully say is, I made some of his C fibers start to fire. And I might think that I consciously observe color, but of course that doesn't exist. So we can scratch off the cause pain and the color. But furthermore, if you think about what this view says, is there even really any me to step back and think about these things? You know, if essentially all I am is a lump of stuff, then the cells of the lump of stuff that existed in third grade are long gone. They've been replaced. And so have John Brooks. And so really, I don't even exist anymore. That was many years ago. And John Brooks doesn't exist anymore either. And so when you apply this view of the world to the sentence, I am reflecting on whether I should have chosen to cause pain to John Brooks to get the crayons, what is all that you have left? Colorless crayons. That is the emptiness and the illogic of this view of the world. Now, before you go rushing to find your local atheist and accusing him of all this stuff, I want you to know, not every atheist thinks this. The guys who are the most famous ones, and the guys that the 18 to 29-year-olds are reading and then go on Facebook and talk trash about, they do believe this. But they've never had anyone confront them with what the full ramifications are of what they believe. But not every atheist does believe this. For example, one atheist philosopher named Thomas Nagel wrote a book called Mind and Cosmos, and here is the subtitle: Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. That's the subtitle. He might as well have said why scientism is false, because that's what it amounts to. And in an article summarizing his book, he says this: a purely physical process cannot explain the existence of conscious human beings. And he's exactly right. But he's an atheist. You want to know why he's an atheist? Several years ago, about a year and a half ago, I had an extended Facebook debate with some friends of mine, actually who live in Sweden, that I met through Singing Barbershop, but who are militant atheists. And they caught me on a day where I was not in the mood for it, and I had my sort of the Popeye the Sailor, I've had all I can stand and can't stand no more moment. So I started challenging them. And we ended up having a very long and fruitful and, I think, substantive debate. But the thing that triggered the whole debate is one of them had posted a quote which basically said, people are religious simply because of wishful thinking. You ever heard that? Religion is just, you know, pie in the sky, sweet by and by. Just you people don't want to think and use reason and use logic. You just don't want to think about there not being a God. That cuts both ways. So let me show you in his own words why this philosopher, who realizes the complete emptiness and illogic of scientism, doesn't believe in God. He says this: it isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope I'm right in my belief. It's that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. Wishful thinking is for atheists too. And ultimately the reason he's an atheist is he just wishes and hopes there isn't a God. Presumably because he doesn't want to have to give an account. I want you to see that based on what we've seen tonight, that the view of the world that says all that exists are lumps of stuff, the view of the world that would say, let us eat and drink for tomorrow we die, is not only profoundly illogical and incoherent as a view of the world, but also it is ultimately driven by a kind of wishful thinking that there's no God to give an account to. But if the arguments we made yesterday morning are true and valid, there's no amount of wishful thinking that can deny the truth of who God is. And instead, what God summons all of us to do is to love him, to embrace him, to realize that in God we find truth and meaning and purpose in life. And that purpose he has above all else is for us to enjoy him and his love forever. That's his purpose for us. And tonight, as we extend the invitation, if you need to respond to Jesus Christ and be baptized into him because you believe Jesus is the Son of God and he died for your sins and he rose again and now sits in heaven and welcomes you to come to him, if there's anything we can do tonight to help you, let us know while we stand and sing together.